everyone. Hope you're doing well. It is Thursday, June 16th, 2022. Welcome back to a brand new edition of the Ariel Helwani Show. I, of course, am Ariel Helwani. Thank you so much to my good friends, the Lovely Feathers, for this great theme song. It is entitled Frantic. I love them very much, and I appreciate them being a part of our little engine that could. And you can say the same about today's guest, a little engine that could, because in the world of boxing, there are a lot of big-time players, a lot of big-time players with big-time contracts, with big-time fighters and big-time networks. And Lou DiBella, who's a very brash, outspoken, kind of shoot-from-the-hip, wears his emotion and his heart on his sleeve, New Yorker, has done things a little differently over the course of his Hall of Fame career. And yes, I stress the term Hall of Fame because just this past weekend, he was inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame among some giants of the game, Andre Ward and Floyd Mayweather, Bernard Hopkins, our old pal, Holly Holm as well. A tremendous honor for Lou DiBella and an honor that, in my opinion, long overdue and well-deserved. He's a great character. Even if you aren't a fan of boxing, I think you will really appreciate this conversation and this character because he is just that, a character. He's captivating when he speaks. He's very smart when he talks about the business of sports. And he's not just involved in the world of boxing. He's actually also involved in the world of baseball as well. He owns two AA franchises. Pretty damn cool. He's a big baseball fan. But of course, he's well known for his work in the world of boxing. Worked at HBO Sports for 11 years. Now runs his own company since 2000, DiBella Entertainment. He has promoted some of the biggest names in the history of the sport and just promoted one of the biggest fights of the year. That was the George Kambosos versus Devin Haney fight over in Melbourne, Australia. So a lot to talk to him about, from the state of boxing to his induction to some of the other promoters that he is a fan or maybe not such a big fan of, to his great career, to how he got into boxing, how he fell in love with the sport, to his love of baseball and so much more. We also talk a little MMA as well, so stay tuned for all of that. It's a great conversation. I think you'll really like it. Before we get to that conversation, though, I do want to thank once again our good friends over at NordVPN for their support. We love NordVPN and I love them and I use them regularly and I'm about to use them because I'm heading to Canada next week. Oh boy, do I love NordVPN, and oh boy, do they save me. And I assume if you are a fan of theirs as well, they save you when you are overseas, because if you love your streaming services, if you love watching your fights on DAZN, on Showtime, on ESPN+, on all these different networks, these OTT platforms, as they say, once you leave the US, you can't watch these fights. You can't use these services. But when you have NordVPN, with a click of a button, it's like you're back home in the US and you're able to watch everything legally. And it's just so darn easy. With NordVPN, you can connect to a faraway location and still freely explore the internet. And because of NordVPN's fast streaming speeds, you can watch your favorite events without any kind of interruption. And guess what? You can use NordVPN on up to 6 devices, even on your smart TV. And best of all, NordVPN lets you use the top streaming platforms at a lower price. What's better than that? So I want you to do this. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/Ariel to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan, plus free threat protection, plus one additional month for free. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's nordvpn.com/Ariel. Please support them because they support us. Now time for my conversation with the inimitable, the incomparable Lou DiBella. Enjoy. You know, from afar, I was actually a little bit jealous. There was a part of me that was like, you know what? I wish I went to this this weekend, because as you alluded to, it was 2020, 2021, 2022, all brought together. I said, I feel like, you know, in the history of Hall of Fames, this might rival the 1936 initial class that went into the Baseball Hall of Fame as the greatest Hall of Fame weekend of all time. Now, obviously, it's 3-in-1 because of the pandemic, but to see all those names, all those figures come together in a sport that at time is, you know, fragmented. Could you maybe elaborate a little bit more on the vibe? It seemed like everyone was happy to be there. There were no beefs.
I got to tell you, man, I'm still in a high over it. It was, first of all, they had us running around like crazy. They really are buttoned up. I mean, it's Canastota, New York is a little town and it comes alive for this. And it really, they suffered deeply not having this induction a couple of years in a row, but they made up for it, man. The whole, like, I was in a, we were in a parade yesterday. I'm a couple of cars behind Mayweather. We're in a parade where, I don't know how, tens of thousands of boxing fans everywhere chanting our names, like knowing everyone, and the embracing from this whole upstate New York community of all of us. You felt like you were in a cradle of like boxing. And it was a remarkable time. And the camaraderie was the thing I'll remember most, you know, hanging out with all these, reminiscing with guys. I grew up in boxing. I mean, I remember I started in my 20s in the late 80s at HBO. So the period of the 90s that saw Mayweather come out into the pros, but also was the time of Roy Jones, the time of James Toney, you know, the Juan Manuel Marquez, Cotto. These were all guys I worked with over the years, and the women that were there also. I mean, these were trailblazers, Leila Ali and Christy Martin, and you know, it was a tremendous sort of spirit. And you know, there's a lot of darkness in boxing. I comment on it too often. I'm not going to comment on it on this phone call because it was nice to see a celebration of a sport that's existed since people were writing on cave walls, that still on its best night can rival or exceed any other sport in terms of worldwide attention. So, you know, it was a great experience for me. It's nice to smell roses when you're still walking this earth, you know, and it's nice to hear people. You know, I felt like I said this in my speech, not in my Hall of Fame acceptance speech, but in the speech at the dinner over there. It's like it was a weird experience, I think, for all of us. It was like listening to your eulogy and you're still alive, you know? And I think every single person there, every single one of the fighters, man, woman, every one of the non-participants that was being honored, they got that same sort of humbling sense of hearing appreciation. Takes a lot of effort and work. I mean, any combat sports are not easy, man. Like for the fighters are a different breed in combat sports, but frankly, so are the people that work in them. Because there's more complications. There's more like, we're the purest form of sport. You know, two men or two women getting in there and fighting, and there's an element of degenerate gambling for everyone involved, almost, because a career can change in a snap, and the fortunes of promoters and managers and trainers can change with that same snap. And it's not the easiest way to earn a living, but it's rewarding, and it's an adrenaline rush. It's been 33 years of adrenaline rush. And the last 5 or 6 days have been really among the most rewarding of and most humbling of my life.
I don't want this to turn into like a boxing versus MMA thing, but I will say this. One of the things that boxing does infinitely better than MMA, in my opinion, is honor its heroes, its legends. And this is why I strongly believe, based on everything you're saying right here, why there needs to be an MMA Hall of Fame. There isn't one. One does not exist.
No, there needs to be an MMA Hall of Fame, and there needs to be. And frankly, with the audience MMA has and the marketing machine that UFC has, there's an opportunity. Look at what the WWE has done with a little Hall of Fame, right? And right. Or that Hall of Fame induction as an event every year that wrestling fans pay attention to. I mean, you know, look, wrestling has a much longer history than MMA, and boxing has a much longer history than all of them. You know, so right. So it's no accident that we. I mean, I think maybe we're better at honoring our past because our past is, I don't know. You can go back to the beginning of time. Right. Whereas UFC MMA is a little bit more of a modern product, but I think the time has come now to start honoring the heroes of MMA and the trailblazers of MMA. I mean, there were a lot of guys that made their bones before there was an omnipotent UFC and a fan base like you have today. So I tend to agree with you. I think that I expect to see, by the way, the emergence of one. I it's too good of a marketing opportunity for people to continue to pass on it. So I think you will see UFC and MMA honor their significant past players.
I would love to see that. To be clear, the UFC has their own, but that to me is like the Knicks, you know, honoring someone in the rafters. There needs to be an independent, like there is an independent boxing, there needs to be an independent MMA Hall of Fame where people are honored regardless of their relationship with the promoter, right? I mean, there's a difference between the DiBella Entertainment Hall of Fame or Top Rank Hall of Fame and the Boxing Hall of Fame in Canastota. But I think you would agree with me on that as well. I feel right now, and I'd love to get your take on this because you were just in Australia for a massive fight and we'll talk about George Kambosos and Devin Haney. I got to be honest with you, Lou. I'm more into boxing right now than I am MMA, and I'm the MMA guy. I feel like boxing is on fire. I feel like every weekend there is a big fight on some network, some platform, and I know it can be splintered. But right now I feel like boxing is more interesting than it has been in quite some time. Do you share that sentiment?
We're on a run, absolutely. But I don't want to beat that drum too loud because I think this run should be sort of a lesson to us and a beginning of a momentum that continues for a number of years, as opposed to the fact we're just a little bit hot in a period where maybe some other people are a little bit less hot. I think we still have a long way to go. I still think that there are, for all the, look, it's a fucking disgrace that we're not announcing Crawford and Spence already, and that that fight is not set. And it's a disgrace. I don't want to beat a negative, drum at the moment, but I hate these exclusive promoters. Because the quality of the product, we've had some great product in recent months, and I think we're on a good roll, right? But we've also had a lot of shit, and there's no excuse for the shit. Combat sports need to have outcomes that are in doubt, and the best have to fight the best. And all of the fighters in any combat sport have a very limited shelf, and the best should be fighting the best with consistency and regularity, not just on a little sort of like nice little kind of run. I think some good things are happening. AJ's going to fight Usyk. That's a good fight. There are some more good fights on the horizon. I'd like to see less impediments to the big fights happening. Look, when I was at HBO in the late 80s, 90s, the big fights happened every month, like literally. And that's where we need to be because, guys, and also I want to see some changes, by the way, in boxing in particular, with fighters wanting the smoke more than they want it. There are guys that have insisted on making things happen. Devin Haney insisted on that opportunity. George Kambosos, as bad of a night as he had in Australia, insisted on a big fight. He wasn't going to fight a key busy fight. So he went from Teofimo Lopez to a contract with Loma. And then when Loma had to go defend his country, it became Devin Haney. And like those, we need to see that kind of fighting spirit from the fighters and their managers. Also, a recognition of the following. George insisted on a big fight, but he got paid. And Devin is now undisputed champion with tremendous amount of market value that he didn't have before he went to Australia. The biggest and best fights make the biggest and best stars. The biggest and best fights make the biggest money. So everybody should be pushing for them. And a fighter shouldn't be happy or accepting of a non-challenge just because he can make some decent money. Go for the gusto, because frankly, that's also where you're going to get the generational money that you apparently seek if you're in a combat sport. Because believe me, as we already said, it's not an easy way to earn a living. So I don't want to get complacent because we're in a good run. I think we need to continue it. I also think we need to improve our regular product. The regular product, the product that goes out on DAZN and these other platforms with regularity has to be more consistent. I'm tired. I won't watch a fight where I know any law. I'm done watching a fight where I know what the outcome is. And there are exceptions. There are fights where a guy's so good, he's fighting someone else who's perfectly appropriate, but I may think I know the winner. Okay, I'll watch that because I want to see the guy that's so good and you're doing as well as you can in the matchmaking. But watching like schnooks get in the ring with world-class guys, I'm done with that. Fuck that. I'll watch a basketball game or I'll watch a UFC fight before I'll watch a boxing match where I know what's going to happen unequivocally.
Is there not a movement though, like with, Kambosos, Loma, then Haney, Taylor Serrano, Crawford Spence, AJ Usyk, AJ maybe fighting, Fury.
Crawford Spence isn't made. Crawford Spence isn't made still. And the interesting thing about Crawford Spence not being made.
Yeah.
I sat with Bud Crawford and hung out with him on a bus ride and talked to him about it. And he said, don't believe the bullshit. Nothing's done. No offer's been made to me that I accepted and nothing's done. There's no date. There's no fight made. So I don't think he was lying to me. And one of the things we both discussed is that he wants it badly and that Spence wants it badly. I think they both want it, but it's not done. And by the way, it's easier to make now that it's been in years because Bud's a free agent. It was harder to make when Bud was attached to ESPN and Spence was attached to PBC and out. But now that Crawford is a free agent, it should be much easier to make.
So can I ask?
We just have a way. We over negotiate things, we let things over ruminate. And when the fights are the hottest, they don't happen. And that's got to change. Like, there is no excuse for Spence Crawford not to happen in 2022. It must happen in 2022.
Is there a case to be made that the fighters in today's generation, the younger fighters, you know, the Crawfords, the Spences, the Tank Davises, et cetera, they want the smoke. But it's actually, from my perspective, I'd love to get your take on this. It's actually the promoters who are, you know, Golden Boy won't do business with Al Haymon. Leonard Ellerbe and Eddie Hearn hate each other. Like, are the promoters the ones who are the biggest impediment now to the big fights being made?
No, the television.
There seems to be a lot of fighting between.
No, the streaming services are. The television networks are. And the promoters, frankly, who have the big, big deals, they're allowed to be the most complacent and laziest. And they can sit there and give you inferior product or tell you a guy's a star because they're running the guy out regularly in fights where he's dominating. And they'll sit there and tell you somebody who's a star is a star when they're really not. And if you match them against the top guys, they wouldn't perform. I think the impediment's not the promoter. It's that contract the promoter has that says ESPN's not buying a fight from anybody else but Bob Arum. And Showtime, for the most part, is an exception. I did a little show the other night, but let's face realities. On the biggest levels, it's Al Haymon and PBC, and that's the case for Fox TV also. Eddie's got his thing with DAZN. Honestly, there's a reason you said Ellerbe and whatever. It's everyone with Eddie a little bit because Eddie's not a great winner, and he's not a very easy person to do business with. He understands the, in effect, sort of monopoly. It's not a monopoly, but the situation he has where if you want on to the DAZN platform, it flows through him. And he takes every advantage of it, and he's a bit of a bully and not so easy to work with if you're on the other side of a street or not in his corporate sphere. So, Eddie spent an entire week, he had other fights going on, shitting all over, worrying about Devin Haney. Well, sorry, if you and DAZN put up the right situation, Devin Haney would have stayed there. Devin Haney went to the better opportunity. Devin Haney didn't do a deal with me and Arum because it was a worse deal for him. And now he's sitting there as undisputed champion. But I don't sit there and talk about Golden Boy's business. I don't sit there and talk about Eddie's business or Arum's business. I worry about my business and the fighters I'm working with. I worry about the sport in a more global sense. I don't blame the promoters, but the situation that, look, if boxing was perceived by the streaming services and networks as must-see powerhouse programming, they wouldn't be doing exclusive deals with anybody. Hmm. Part of the reason they're doing exclusive deals is, I don't have to, let Arum worry about it. I put the stuff up and it performs to a certain level. And we're content with that because in the sphere of sport, we're paying a fraction for boxing of what we're paying for major team sports, the system of exclusivity needs to change. If ESPN had somebody there like I was at HBO in the 90s, and that was the case across the board where there were no exclusive deals or exclusive promotional entities, we were trying to make the biggest and best fights, and there were competing networks trying to make the biggest and best fights, you would have great programming. And lately, I think we're on a good stretch, right? Mm. Even with that exclusivity, but it's still not easy. You never heard in the 80s or 90s or early 2000s about different sides of the street. You didn't. You never heard a fighter hiding behind his side. No, you never heard that. You never heard fans mention who's with what promoter. And by the way, who gives a shit who's promoting a fight? You want to see the best fight. If I'm an MMA fan and the best fight's UFC, I'm going to watch that. If there's a tremendous fight on PFL, I'm going to watch that. I don't even get this whole shit with promoters going out there tooting their own fucking horns like they're celebrities. Now, I get that Amy's a celebrity. Good, man. Go do as many interviews as you want in the UK. But guess what? Fight fans in America, we don't give a fuck. We want to see a great fight. That's what people want to see. Whether you're promoting it or I'm promoting it or Aram's promoting it or anybody else is promoting it, it's about the fighters. The fighters are the sport. The fighters are MMA. The fighters are boxing. That's where the fucking focus should be, not on promoters. And exclusivity between a network and a promoter is horseshit. It does is make it more difficult to make the biggest and best fights.
Are there any promoters that you won't work with or who won't work with you?
No, I don't think there's anyone who won't work with me. Honestly, there's no one I won't work with. Eddie and I are not in a good place right now, but I mean, I've known him since he's a kid. Can we work together? We've worked together hundreds of times. I can work with anybody. And honestly,
a good place?
Hey, Ariel, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have survived. I haven't had an exclusive platform for 5 or 6 years. I've had between 50 and 60 fighters that entire time. And my company is okay, but it's because I can do business with everybody. But you think I want to turn my product over to other people if I don't have to, or partner with people time and time again because I am to the platform? That's not how I would rather operate. But I could work with anybody. But I'll tell you something. The sport would be a lot better if everybody could work with everybody. And it was much more like that 25 years ago. It really was. And any promoter out there that's had the longevity I've had, there's a lot of them that are older than I am. They'll tell you that I'm right. It was much more cooperative and collegial 25 years ago, 20 years ago.
Could I ask, why are you and Eddie not in a good spot right now?
It's very different people, man. Like we're just like, you know, part of it is just, I don't think a little bit like oil and water. Honestly, we're just very different people. And a lot of it is like, I'm not, you know, it's easy to be a good guy when you're sort of struggling and you need friends. And it's harder to be a good guy when you're spending other people's money and sitting on the top of a sort of an ivory tower and earning. I mean, this guy has the benefit of making crazy amounts of money while his partner, streaming service, has lost billions in recent years. And he still has the kind of deal that allows him to thrive, even if the partner he has isn't so much thriving. And it's very difficult. Yeah, I'm not saying that it's totally a closed shop at the Zone. It's not. I'm not saying that. It's mostly a closed shop. And Eddie is absolutely the king of the Zone boxing, the face of it, the king of it. It's his little empire. Harder to be a good guy when you're controlling your own little empire. And honestly, I don't think he does such a great job at that. I think, you know, and I also think that he's very, very interested in building it's about his face, his brand. I mean, dude, just go and look at face-ups of fights. And fucking, honestly, the fighter looks like a little fucking dot on each side, and there's Eddie in the middle. And, you know, it's reminiscent to me a little bit of how Don King promoted at the top of his game in the 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, where, you know, he correctly believed that he was a bigger star than most of his fighters. And I think if you go to Eddie's persona as an influencer, to his status as an influencer and his ability to dominate boxing press in the UK, it's very much about him being a bigger star than most of his fighters.
To be honest, I thought you were going to say it's very reminiscent of Dana White, especially in his early days, in the middle, present, doing a bunch of, you know, like, this feels like, the whole thing feels like Dana White's.
Yeah, but I want to tell you something. There was more of a fairness to Dana. There was more of a reason for Dana to take that position back then. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was a company that needed to be built and a brand needed to be built. And honestly, the guy, the Fertittas and the people running it back when, lost enough fucking money in the beginning while it was, you know, growing and percolating and whatever. I mean, I think Eddie's had these dreams of being Dana, honestly. I think, you know, look, he said them on the record over the recent years. He was going to come to America and he was going to blow everyone out of the water. All the black fighters were going to sign with this white billionaire from the UK that, you know, honestly, not the most relatable guy if you're a poor kid from the hood. Right. But he was going to come here and he was going to have this giant budget. He was going to blow us the fuck all out of the water. No, nope. Sorry. Didn't work. And nor is Eddie ever going to build a UFC of boxing. And frankly, I don't think boxing, I think boxing is beyond, it's prohibited too long. We're the wild, wild west. There is no barriers to entry. I don't believe anybody is going to create a UFC of boxing. Like, I don't see one entity completely having the dominant market sort of control that UFC was able to muster. But UFC did that at a time where MMA was down and not particularly accepted, not even legal in most states. To some extent, they earned their de facto monopoly by investing and taking the chance. I don't disagree with what you said about Dana early on or whatever. I just don't see where Eddie thinks this is getting him, and nor do I see any evidence that he's capable of blowing us all out of the water and becoming the quote-unquote UFC of boxing.
Dana has flirted with boxing, but then now he says, you know, it's too broken and whatnot. Do you think he could have success in the world of boxing, given what you know about him as a guy?
I think that the people, there are a lot of smart people. I've done a lot of stuff with the guys at UFC. I know them pretty well. They're very smart people. And I think they also get the fact that right now they got to worry about their own mothership. They got to worry about their product. And yeah. And I don't think boxing is eternal. Boxing's not going anywhere. We've had our issues, but we will never. No, I mean, people will always fight for other people's entertainment the same way people will always. There'll always be pornography for other people. Like, we're guilty pleasure fighting, and honestly, we all fight. I said this in my Wallace fame speech. It's what makes the combat sports so relatable. They're metaphors for life. Everybody fights. You get knocked on your ass, you got to get fucking up. You know, all of us are going to lose we're going to lose family members. We're going to lose friends. We're going to lose money. We're going to have demons to battle. We all have battles in our lives. We are only here for a short time. And that is what makes the fight game. And I'm talking about all combat sports, including MMA. That's what makes us different and so relatable, right? We are an eternal, you know, sport. I don't know, man. I think that, I've been highly critical of my own sport for a long time. Comes from a place of love, not from a place of hate, because I think that we can be better than we were. We were the sport in the early 20th century. And we've managed sort of to allow ourselves to sort of slip in that pantheon of sports. But at our best, I don't think there's anybody or anything better. I think our best night is better than your best night. And I would say that to almost every sport.
Mm-hmm. No, I think there's a strong case to be made. Could I ask, one thing that I've always respected about you is you promoted, you know, women's boxing long before it was cool to do so, right? And you have been on the front lines and you have taken chances. And you were by Amanda Serrano's side for a very long time. You weren't a part of
the entire ride up until a fight or two ago.
What was it like?
Yeah, look, I don't regret championing women's sports at all. And honestly, if one of the little sort of reasons that I'm a first ballot Hall of Famer was because I championed women's sports before other people in North America, clearly, I mean, there was no one else doing women's boxing with any regularity. And believe me when I say I'm upside down to this day on women's boxing. I'm grateful if I'm perceived as somebody that helped that cause. And I really felt that this Hall of Fame weekend, where the first three classes ever of women's boxers were inducted into the Hall of Fame. Other women professionals, Kathy Duver, promoter, Margaret Goodman, ringside physician, were inducted into the Hall of Fame. I met some real trailblazers, people that really preceded the curve in terms of, you know, when you know, Christy Martin, the sacrifices she made for women's boxing, and you know, Layla was a trailblazer, but the women before them that were honored, you know, it was moving to me to see their success and to feel like maybe had a little bit to do with it. And believe me, they did it. Like, they're the reason things are getting better. But people can't get complacent, because there's still exploitation of women in women's boxing. And I made a deal the same week that Taylor Serrano was going on for a fight involving one of my best female talents that I felt was an exploitative deal, but she had no place else to go. And I went to her and said, I don't love the deal I can make for you right now, but I gave her complete disclosure. Here's everything there. Here's what you're going to make. Here's what I'm going to make. And, you know, I made a deal. But it's still a very difficult world for the female fighter, and not an equal playing field. And they're never going to have equality. And frankly, you know, market conditions and demand and stuff like that, you know, equality may be too much to ask for. However, fairness isn't, and we're not yet at fairness. There is no regular series for female fighters. There are scores of women that can beat existing champions that have no opportunity to get on television. There are scores of tremendous female talents, Olympians, young women coming out of Golden Gloves programs that can fight their rear ends off, that work just as hard as the men, that don't have a developmental series to show their skills. And there's nobody from an ESPN to a DAZN to a Fox to a Showtime to any fucking platform out there that's really a champion for women. There's not.
But to watch what happened April 30th and not be a part of it, as you were so instrumental in building Amanda Serrano in this market, and the fight happened in this market, MSG, what was that like for you? Were you even able to watch it?
Oh, I watched it, you know, and I wasn't going to miss it. I didn't go. Did it hurt? Yeah, it hurt. I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, I'm 60 years old plus. I run two minor league baseball teams. I got a production company. I'm still a force in boxing. I got the gold ring of the Hall of Fame, which, believe me, was, you know, really, really gratifying. But I don't give so much of a fuck anymore, right? So I'm going to say what I feel. And yeah, it hurt. Of course it hurt, you know? That being said, I was happy it happened. I was happy that that garden was full, and I was happy that it was exactly the fight I expected it to be. Those are two of the greatest women that have ever put on boxing gloves. And you can make an argument that it might be the two best, you know, but it's two of the greatest women that have put on boxing gloves, and they threw down. And by the way, everyone should stop with the talk of 3-minute rounds. Embrace the fact that women's boxing is its own thing, and that the sports their fights are much more active, much quicker pace, and have a tremendous rate of activity that the male game doesn't have, and that women's boxing is a little bit safer than the men's game. And the idea of changing the rules now to make it less safe because a few women think they'll score more knockdowns, the people that are really screaming about the difference between 3 and 2 minute rounds are haters, or people making excuses for why you only fight 2 minutes, or no, those fucking people are never going to accept women's boxing or give the women the credit that they deserve. But I want to tell you something. You very rarely see a shit women's fight. And the reason for that is the women get out there and there is no stopping. There is no resting. There's no taking a minute off. They get out there and they throw down. And by the way, women give birth. Women bear children. Women's thresholds for pain are better than men's. And increasing the length of the rounds is not going to increase in a major way the number of knockouts. You want to increase the number of knockouts, make the gloves smaller, which, by the way, is safer, where adding minutes is more dangerous. So the idea that women should add minutes, make the sport less attractive to TV, because you and I know that shorter fights are desirable by TV executives and streaming executives, that people today want immediate gratification and an action compact into a smaller period of time. It's not going to make the product better, you know, and it's going to make it less safe. And I don't want to see that. And I also really like the 2-minute rounds. I love the pace of a women's fight. I love it. I enjoy it. And if you think it's so difficult right now to get, there's no network, as we said, doing a series to develop women or saying, I need a women's boxing series. You think longer fights are going to make them think that they, you know, I won't give you, you know, 30 minutes to make a title fight, but I'm going to jump over backwards to give you 50 minutes. No, it's not how it works.
Would it be a massive blunder? And it seems like we're going in that direction. To not do the immediate rematch. From your perspective, it looks like Amanda's going to fight someone else on August 6th, not Katie Taylor. They had something special, talking of Croke Park in Ireland or running it back here in New York City. Is that a massive blunder?
Okay, but it was never going to Ireland. There's a reason why the fight never happened abroad. And I don't have proof of the exact reason, but I believe if they ever fight again, it's not going to wind up happening abroad.
Okay.
I believe if they fight again, it'll happen.
Can you tell us what the reason is?
I don't know, but look, I mean, it's not easy necessarily to travel. If you've ever made a mistake in your past, in your life, it's not so easy to travel. You know, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but it doesn't shock me that it's not going to happen in Ireland.
Got it.
You know?
Okay. But the fact that it's not happening next, is that a mistake in your opinion anywhere?
I mean, yeah, no. I mean, neither one of them, you know, I mean, if it never, look, boxing is unpredictable. So if you have something that big, you sort of want to go right to it again.
Yeah.
Because who knows what happens in the interim, right?
Right, right.
Will the fight be less big in the spring or the end of the year? I don't know. I don't necessarily think it's like horrible that it's not immediately happening.
Okay.
The other thing too is like, look, fairness to Amanda, 35 is not her best weight.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she really is a pure featherweight. I mean, she's right. fought as low as 115. She fought 115 for a title and then fought 140 3 months later. Yeah. And the idea, and you know what? Does she deserve her Ring Magazine belt and her accolades for unifying the weight class? I think she does. So I'm not troubled with Amanda or Jordan wanting to, you know, get Jake to help them get an undisputed title. I don't know. You know, as long as it's, you know, she's on a Jake undercard where he can determine how he's spending his undercard money and his money. That's something I couldn't do for them. I couldn't get Showtime to make a deal with Amanda or DAZN to make a deal with Amanda or ESPN to make a deal with Amanda. I tried. And by the way, I might have been able, honestly, also to make some arguments about why maybe I was entitled to keep working together. But you know what? When, you know, we had a nice run together, and I would never have done anything to block Taylor Serrano from happening. I have too much invested in my soul with women's boxing, wanting to see it grow and change, that I was never going to be an impediment to that fight ultimately happening. But I can understand why Amanda wants to unify featherweight and get a Ring Magazine belt. She's earned that.
Speaking of immediate rematches, are we going to see Kambosos Haney 2 right away? Is that the next fight for George Kambosos?
I haven't really talked to George or his dad since the fight in any detail. They have the right to cause it. I think he can fight better. I thought, honestly, he fought a shitty fight. I think there were some distractions that need to disappear. I wasn't thrilled that he missed weight. And I think the week of the fight, there was a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of distractions. I don't want to get into details, but and it looked to me that Haney and his team were the more focused team leading up to the fight. I think George can fight a lot better, and I think the rematch would be more pleasing than the first fight. I think it's likely he's going to exercise the rematch clause, and I think it's likely that Haney will honor it. So I think it's likely, but I can't definitively say.
Is it a tough sell for Australia, for ESPN? Like, can you go back, same condition, let's say it's in November, and do this all over again, considering how one-sided
it
was?
You can't go back to a stadium.
No.
You can't think you're going to sell 42,000 seats or 40,000 seats again. But can you go to an arena and sell it out? And can George make it much more of an entertaining fight? Yes. Can you load an undercard that has significant Australian talent and that would appeal to boxing fans in Australia, where you could sell out a 22,000-seat arena? Yes. So is it an easy sell? No, it wasn't a scintillating first fight. It wasn't. And it was a dominant boxing clinic. George never sold out. He never committed to walk past that jab and take chances. I was very surprised by that part of the fight. You know, I mean, he was getting tagged with every jab anyway. So I would have sort of expected that he would have walked through more and taken more chances. But it just, sometimes you don't have your night. And you know what? He had never fought in front of 4,000 people in Australia, forget about 42,000. And your home, your first real fight of your career at home, is this extravaganza. And it's very easy to get sort of caught up in it. It's not an excuse. You know, he got his head handed to him. But I know that he can fight better than that. And I know that a rematch will be a better fight. Is it an easy sell? No, but you know, that's what Aram, you know, Top Rank and Aram, myself, my staff, that's what we're good at. So it's on us a little bit to do the right things to make it an event. But if they exercise the rematch and Haney accepts it, we'll make an event of it.
In your Hall of Fame speech, you talked about being a 10-year-old boy listening to Ali Frazier on radio, or at least listening for updates, right? So you couldn't even listen to it live?
No, you couldn't listen to it live. It was round by round updates. They tell you who won each round. And I remember also sitting there, and I'd be trying to real quickly go from INS to CBS to see how they both scored it.
Wow.
But I was, you know, I was a little kid, man. And My father knew I was doing it, but he got a little bit of a kick out of it, so he let me do it. But I'd be sitting there listening to it under my pillow. And you know, to be 50 years later, to be inducted into a Hall of Fame on the same stage as Muhammad's daughter, Layla. You know, like I said this on the stage, man, I've been blessed. Like, those guys were my ultimate heroes. They became my friends. I was at both their funerals. I know their families. I mean, Hagler, Hearn, Leonard, and Duran, when I was in college and law school, those were my fucking heroes. They became my friends. And every significant boxer over the last 30 years, I know them, every one of them, even if I didn't promote them. I mean, I've been blessed, man. I mean, I love this sport and I love baseball and I run two minor league baseball teams and I'm a Hall of Fame boxing promoter. And man, my life has been, and I've been fortunate. And I don't, you know, I am the kind of guy that's a little bit like, complain about this, complain about that. That's a fair criticism of me. It comes from a good place, but I'm not going to bullshit you. It's a little bit of that in me. And to have this experience of the last 5 days and to really get to reflect on your whole career and see so many people you care about and interact with all these boxing fans who are, what I must, I'm blessed, man. You know, I'm humbled right now. I don't know how much, I don't know how much longer this adrenaline rush will last, but I'm feeling real good the last few days.
I love that we're catching you in this mood, a little reflective and grateful. It's a beautiful thing. I want to ask you about the baseball stuff in a moment, but could I ask who introduced you to boxing? Like, do you remember the first time that you were introduced?
Oh, I do actually. I'll tell you what it was. And it was interesting because in a lot of weird ways, it's the same introduction as I got to baseball. My grandparents were Italian immigrants and, you know, Italian first language for both of my grandfathers. And both of them came over here with this like wanting to be American kind of thing. So they got over here and they tried to learn about baseball or watch baseball. But the sport that back then you didn't get a lot of soccer. You weren't getting soccer games televised in the United States or available on TV. So the only sport that they grew up with that was really televised here was boxing. And at the time I was a little kid, there was a great Italian fighter, Nino Benvenuti, who, you know, to this day is probably the greatest Italian fighter who's ever lived. And he was fighting fairly regularly on American TV. He was the king of the middleweight division for a period of time. And literally, I don't even think I was like first grade or second grade. I was a little kid. And I remember watching a Nino Benvenuti fight with one of my grandparents, my grandfather. And my grandfather rooting so hard for Nino because he was the Italian fighter. And I didn't really know sports at that point very much. I mean, I'd watch baseball a little bit and I'm sitting there and I'm watching a fight. But guess what? It's easy to understand the fight. Two guys are fighting. Which guy's beating up the other guy? It's not like rocket science. It's why I've always said, by the way, children might make better judges than politically influenced judges attached to ratings organizations and commissions. Right. But put that aside. But as a kid, I'm like, you know, man, I can dig this fighting kind of thing, you know? And that my first introduction was watching a Nino Benvenuti fight. My second introduction wasn't even a fight. It was watching an interview with Muhammad Ali and saying to myself, wow, I mean, this is the prettiest, best spoken, most charismatic, like most captivating human being I've ever seen. Hmm. And just watching that interview with Ali, I had a new hero. And then I started seeking out Ali fights and, you know, watching anything on Ali that was on. If Ali was on an interview or on TV or whatever, my mother or father always called me in because they knew, like, you know, how much Ali was my guy. And after, from the first time I saw Muhammad Ali, boxing was ingrained in my soul, my heart. And I don't think I'm the only person that felt that way. I can tell you there's a lot of people my age, even a little bit younger, whose introduction to boxing was Ali. And that was it. I mean, we were hooked. So that's really where I trace my love for boxing to.
When did you first meet Ali?
I was first met Ali around 1990. I was at HBO and Time Warner. He did a book called Healing, and had some books that were on Warner Brothers. You know, that Time Warner had been involved with, and I got to sort of work with him and Lonnie, his wife, in promoting those books and doing some public appearances and personal appearances. And he took a liking to me, and he was, I never knew Ali 100% healthy, but I knew Ali bright-eyed and smart and quick and doing magic tricks and really expressing. I mean, look, he's one of the, it's very rare that you have a hero and you meet the guy and he exceeds your expectations. Okay. But I can say that that was the case with Ali. And to a degree, it was the case with Frazier, both of whom knew what they meant to my lives, both of whom in the times I was able to spend with them and the communication I had with them, treated me beautifully and allowed me to continue to love them as much as I did when I was a little child.
How'd you get the HBO job?
It's a pretty cool story, actually. I was interviewing to be general counsel of the New York Yankees.
Wow.
I was 29 years old. I was working at Sullivan and Cromwell, a big law firm. I had a great experience at that law firm, by the way. I learned a lot about how to think like an attorney and how to think critically and stuff. But everyone I worked with at that law firm knew I wanted to be in sports or entertainment. And as long as I did my job, they didn't really care. But they knew that I didn't plan to stay forever. I planned on trying to get a gig in sports or entertainment. I was able to have a bunch of interviews for the Yankees general counsel job. This was 1989. And I interviewed with numerous Yankee executives, and it got narrowed down to three people. And I had an interview scheduled with George Steinbrenner.
Wow.
It was on a Friday. I'll never forget this. And I went to my boss at Sullivan Cromwell, told him I needed a day off. He asked me why. I told him the truth. He said, good luck, because the people there were really cool. They knew what my heart wanted to do. And they weren't like, they wanted to see me make that kind of move, which, by the way, I'll always be grateful for that too. But I got a call. Back then, a lot of people didn't even have cell phones, but if you had one, like I did, it was big. Mm-hmm. But I was sitting in my apartment, my apartment phone rang, and it's Steinbrenner's secretary. And she's sheepish as hell. I pick up the phone, it's almost like silence on the other end. And then I hear this little low voice, this is so-and-so, I'm George Steinbrenner's assistant. And she tells me that George was canceling the interview, that he had looked at my resume and he said, you have an incredibly impressive resume. But he didn't want to hire a kid in his 20s to be the chief lawyer for the Yankees. So there were three finalists. I was one of them. I got eliminated before I got into the final interview.
Ah.
But the secretary did me a real favor. She said, I think the guy that's getting offered the job was interviewing for a job as the chief lawyer for HBO Sports. Bang, light goes off in my head. HBO Sports, boxing, Seth Abraham. I put my resume in my pocket. I had my suit already on because I was planning on going up to the Bronx. Instead of going to the Bronx, I went to 42nd Street and 6th Avenue, snuck past security in the HBO building, which you could still do because it was 10 years prior to 9/11. Talked my way up the stairs, went to see the lawyer at HBO and say, you're about to hire the wrong guy. Got into Seth Abraham's office on a Friday afternoon, spent 90 minutes with Seth talking about boxing, talking about baseball, telling him that I was the right guy. That was a Friday afternoon. Monday, I took an enormous pay cut, but accepted a job at HBO. And then sort of the rest is history. So That's how I got the job at HBO.
What a story. That is unbelievable. And I don't know if I ever told you this, but I worked at HBO as well. I missed you. I was an intern there in 2003. And then the following year, I worked as a PA in their documentary department. So when I was in college, I was a big boxing fan. I loved their journalism sport. To me, they were the gold standard. And unfortunately, they're no longer in boxing. Do you ever foresee?
No, I mean, it's mind blowing to me that
out of boxing. Can they get back?
But it's no accident, by the way. Yeah, that period of time that I was at HBO, Mark Taffet was there working on pay per view stuff. Russ Greenberg was executive producer. I originally was working with a guy named Bob Greenway, who preceded me, but became one of the heads of the Golf Network, which was he was a great programming guy. And I mean, I worked with. And the producers like Dave Harmon and Thomas Odelfelt, John Crystal. I mean, it was the glory days of HBO Sports. And we were a force, not only in boxing, we were a force in sports programming. We were a major sports division at a growing network that was growing like a snowball rolling down a mountain. So, I mean, I learned a lot from the people I worked with. I mean, they were very smart people, very competitive people. I mean, I don't know how Seth did it, because every one of us, you know, had a huge ego and a huge amount of ambition, like maybe a little bit of blind ambition. All everybody wanted to run HBO Sports. Everybody wanted a bigger gig. But it was a great time to be at HBO, and it was a tremendous learning experience for me. And working with people that smart every day makes you so much sharper and better. You know, so I'm grateful to not only to Seth, but everyone I worked with when I was at HBO.
Any chance they get back in? Do you foresee that day?
You know, maybe. It wouldn't shock me for one reason. I think Discovery is about to do a deal mm-hmm. with HBO, and HBO Sports assets would be part of the Discovery group. And they have Eurosport in Europe. You know, boxing is huge in Europe. Boxing After Dark brands and logos still exist. HBO Championship Boxing, they have an incredible library of fights and of docus and programming for HBO. Maybe there is an opening with that new deal. Maybe Discovery will see an opportunity. I certainly can see an opportunity for them, but who knows? You know.
You mentioned the baseball team, so you own two: the Montgomery Biscuits and the Richmond Flying Squirrels. Unbelievable names, by the way. Two AA affiliates, one for the Giants, one for the Tampa Bay Rays. How the hell did you get into this? And is this a lucrative business?
Oh, it's a lucrative business. If you're a good operator, it's a lucrative business. It's like anything else. It's a very lucrative business if you're good at it. And also, you know, part of it is what market are you in? I mean, Richmond's an incredible market. We consistently lead, you know, are like league leaders in attendance and up at the top attendance teams in AA. You know, Montgomery's a smaller city, but it's an incredible city. It's the cradle of the civil rights movement. One of the things I want to do in our ballpark, we have a historic ballpark and a historic part of town. It's sort of part of that civil rights tour. It's in that area of Montgomery. I want to talk to Bob Kendrick at the Negro League Hall of Fame. I want to do some kind of a, you know, historical permanent exhibit in our ballpark. But I love the Montgomery market. I love the Rays people. They're a great organization. The Giants are like, I mean, the Giants, Yankees, Red Sox. I mean, they're the Dodgers. They're those core organizations in minor league and baseball in general that are the gold standard. And I think the Giants are one of those organizations that's a gold standard. And I've always been affiliated. You know, I was in Connecticut with what's now the Richmond Flying Squirrels from the early 2000s. One of the first things I did when I left HBO was invest in a minor league baseball team, because I love baseball. I wanted to be in baseball. I didn't really think I would ever be the person of authority in two major league affiliated minor league teams. That's another dream I was able to realize. That balance is beautiful with boxing. Boxing is sort of a guilty, little bit of a dark pleasure. And minor league baseball is like family entertainment, sort of like, you know, a much more affordable family entertainment than any major league sport. And you're getting to see a lot of the best players, and double A players are the ones that go and jump generally from double A right to the minors. So you're seeing superstar talent when they're still hungry and not so affected by the big time. I love minor league baseball, and I think it's a great experience for anyone who gets the opportunity to watch it. And it's great family entertainment, and it's been very rewarding to have that alongside boxing in my life.
And that's not an issue. There's no conflict there. Like, you can own multiple teams
in different leagues. I have the Montgomery Biscuits are in the Southern League. The Richmond Flying Squirrels were in the Eastern League. So you can own multiple teams. Yeah. Well, actually, right now, Endeavor, the guys that own UFC are becoming a huge power player in minor league baseball. They've bought over 10 teams and they see the big business potential of minor league baseball. It's content, it's programming. There are great athletes participating. And, you know, I think they're also buying teams that have affiliations with some of the bigger markets. And I think they understand that, you know, a Yankee or a Dodger, or, you know, there are teams that those affiliations are very valuable. And Endeavor's becoming a big player in minor league baseball. I think that now that the minor leagues report directly to the commissioner's office, it's a different paradigm. but I think it maybe is a more sensible paradigm. I enjoy personally working with the guys at MLB. I think they're learning that I know what I'm doing too, and that the people that work for me have a great management team in baseball. I have a guy that's like a complete legend named Parney, Todd Parnell, who's like literally like a Bill Veeck of this generation. And we know what we're doing. We do it well. And I enjoy working and interacting with MLB on the minor league stuff. And it sort of energizes me actually a little bit more in boxing because I have other outlets for my sanity and talents.
Would you ever consider or want to own a piece of a major league team?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Much more so if someone ever came to me and said, Lou, we think you're good at what you do. And like, you know, I could have a role as opposed to just raising somebody or being like, I'm never good. Like, I'm not Eddie or Arab in terms of my nest egg. So like, you know, the cost of the major league teams, I'm not going to walk in there as a major investor. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you have to be wealthy to be a limited partner. Mm-hmm. Which I probably could pull off, but I'd rather if I like the involvement, the activity with the minor league stuff, that I'm able to have a real role. If I was given the opportunity to be part of a team that was going to try to get a major league team, would I be interested in it? Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, I'd be interested in it.
Just a couple more left. And again, thank you very much for the time. I read an interview with you that was in the Daily News recently, and you had an interesting line there that kind of, I understood why it was put in there, but I would love to ask you to elaborate on it. You said, if the UFC isn't careful, they're in danger of becoming niche as well. Something to that effect, I'm paraphrasing. What did you mean by that?
You know, pay-per-view is a hard distribution mechanism. Combat sports are a difficult world to navigate. And, you know, I think that they have to, they became the dominant combat sport for a period of time. I think we're making it a little bit closer now. But I think their competition, particularly with the magnitude of the deal they made when they were purchased and the fact that they're capable of right now able to gather a lot of eyeballs, they can't get comfortable because they're doing well in the combat sports arena. They have the same need to build a greater and wider fan base and try to become competitive in that general pantheon of all sports, including the team sports. So I really meant by it is they need to stay on their toes. And look, I mean, you have the perception, you have some disgruntled fighters, players in the industry that are, you know, it's not a great thing that you're constantly listening to UFC fighters saying they want to fight Jake Paul or want to get into boxing. You know, our biggest stars make crazy amounts of money. Now, that being said, there's a little bit of illusion with all these guys wanting to get into boxing because similar to UFC, our bigger stars make the majority of the money. And you know, it's not so easy. You cross into boxing as a UFC fighter, unless you're a star fighter already, you're crossing over to something that's just as limited in terms of your potential earnings as MMA is. You know, however, if you're a huge brand and you can get out there and you can fight, you know, your Francis, and you can get out there and make a fight with Tyson Fury, or you're given the opportunity to fight another superstar, a Mayweather or somebody else like that, there's going to be opportunity to make money that you never dreamed of. You know, I think that for the right fight, a Holly Holm or a Chris Cyborg or somebody could cross back, you know, Holly in her case, she just got into the Hall of Fame, very deserved honor, by the way, because people who never watched her fights or understood how good a boxer she was. She was a great boxer. But there are opportunities maybe for those kind of ladies to cross over. The point I was making, it was not a negative comment about UFC. It was just more like, we're still a combat sport. Our audience is, you know, not everybody loves combat sports. Not every parent wants their kid to become a fan of combat sports. And also, I think that you have a perception, and many other people do, that maybe in the last year or two, boxing's made some inroads to sort of catch up. Only point I was making is they got to be on their toes. So do we.
Right. And it's nice to see this love that you have for MMA, because of course a lot of MMA fans may have been first introduced to you on that infamous SportsCenter segment where you went up against Joe Rogan, hosted by Brian Kenny.
Yeah, but he was no more right than I was.
Oh, no, it was just great. It was great television. Do you regret doing that, by the way?
It's a whole other thing, but I was like discombobulated that day. It's a whole other story, but I'd had a real bad day.
Okay.
And people forget, too, the way that that thing really ended, the first time it was aired, I think it was actually on TV the first time it was aired, was at the end of it, Rogan like blew me a kiss, and I flipped him the bird. But I don't think that that last little part is on the YouTube video or anything.
Do you regret doing that?
I regret the fact I need to fucking hear about it every fucking day of my life.
Still? You still get asked about it a lot?
Dude, this weekend, forget about it. I mean, and particularly, I can't go to an MMA event without like a million people busting my balls. Do I regret doing it? I don't regret anything. I mean, who gives a shit?
Good. Last thing. What's your, your most?
Excuse me. I think weirdly, had I not done that interview, I actually made an effort after that interview to learn a little bit more about it. And as I saw the product get better, and as I watched it, began to appreciate the quality of anime and what they sacrifice and what they do. And, I got to really learn the sport a little bit. It made me appreciate it. And I'm not going to say I'm a hardcore fan now, but I consider myself a fan, like more of a casual, but I'm a fan.
I like it. Since you're in this reflect mood, I just wanted to ask, as you look back, and you're far from done, but as you look back on what you have accomplished so far, what is your proudest achievement? What are you most proud of that you've accomplished in boxing?
I think I changed the way TV executives viewed the sport. I think that I became much more active as a sort of a matchmaker and wanting to, like, the same kind of quality control HBO wanted for its dramatic series and movies and documentaries. I tried to institute that in boxing. And I think that influenced a lot of people. Maybe not as much as I would like. I think today I would like to see more quality control being exercised by some of the players, but I think that was a big contribution. I think I opened up boxing for the lower weight classes, no question about that. Before I started at HBO, very few featherweights and below were getting any attention at all. I think I helped women as a promoter. I don't want to sound egotistical, but if everything ended tomorrow, I've had a good run, and I'm proud of a lot of what I've done. And I think I've left the legacy. So it's nice to feel that way and not be ancient yet. Mm.
Congratulations. Incredible run. Congrats on the Hall of Fame nod this past weekend. Really cool to see. And thanks for always being so kind to me and for giving me the time of day. Early on, a lot of boxing people weren't so kind and willing to speak to the MMA guy. So I always appreciated that from you, and appreciate you giving us an hour.
And thanks for giving me this platform. And I got to be honest, I like speaking to your audience. I actually think there's still a kinship between fans of all combat sports. We understand how our sports differ from others and how the athletes in our sports are different from others. I mean, fighters are a different breed, and that goes for every variety of fighter.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, good luck to your Mets. Not a bad start.
Let's go Mets, man. I'm so fucking happy. And I can say it on your show. Let's fucking go Mets.
Thank you, Lou. All the best.
Thank you.
How great was that? I love talking to these characters, these promoters, these managers, these deal makers, if you will, the executives. The business of sports and the business of combat sports has always been very interesting to me, and I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And really cool that he's also involved in the world of baseball. Minor league baseball is a fascinating world as well. So that was great stuff, relevant stuff, interesting stuff, passionate stuff. Lou DeBell, one of the great characters in the history of boxing. An honor to speak to him, especially a couple of days removed from his Hall of Fame induction. Mazel tov to Lou DeBell on that. Hope you enjoyed it. If you want to watch it, go to youtube.com/Ariel Helwani. That's where you can see the whole interview. You can see our recent stuff with Rosie Perez and the great Ricky Hatton, Devin Haney before his fight. We had him up there. We've had so many great interviews over the past few months from the likes of Dan Le Batard and Michelle Beadle and Pat McAfee and AJ Hawk and Daniel Ricciardo, the great MJF, who's very relevant in the world of pro wrestling, Action Bronson, Emma Lovewell, and the list goes on and on. Go check them all out either on the YouTube channel or on this feed. They're all up there. I'm very proud of the work that we've done over the past year. And yeah, it's been a year now officially since I've left ESPN, and this was one of my big things that I wanted to do, and I think a lot of people thought I wouldn't do it, and now here we are a year later with a great library of interviews and a lot of big names. I'm very proud of all the guests that we've had and the quality of the conversations that we've put out, and I really appreciate your support. There is more to come. We may take a bit of a break here, a little summer break, if you will, but don't worry, I'm going to pop up here and there, and I know most of you just kind of see the stuff on social media and click on it or subscribe here, so you'll be well informed. If you aren't subscribing, please do, and please rate, review, and leave a comment. Do all the things that people say you should do with podcasts, because it's very important, and it helps, and we appreciate you all very, very much. I also appreciate our great production team. And I also appreciate the good folks over at NordVPN for supporting our little engine that could. Thank you very much to them as well. Go to nordvpn.com/Ariel to get your great NordVPN deal exclusive to our listeners/viewers. Again, thank you very much to Lou DiBella. Hope you all enjoy your weekend. I'll talk to you very soon, all right? Don't worry. We'll be back very soon with plenty more great conversations. For now, though, again, great weekend. Check out some of our old stuff. Thank you to Lou. Thank you to all of you. I love you all. I'll see you soon.